folks, welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your host, David Price. Thanks for joining me today. You're going to hear from Steve, and we also have, you'll hear from Steve and Andrew, and Steve will also recap his adventures in Boston. So we have that to look forward to, and I'll talk about something that I talked about this past week in 11 O'Clock Comics. If you haven't caught up with that, we'll touch on it here as well. So we're going to have Steve and Andrew go now, and I'll be back in a little bit.
Hey, mindless ones in the dark dimension. Servants of the Eternal Vishanti, Steve Raker and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit here, in our astral forms, of course, coming to you from the ethereal mindscape of the comic book bunker. Thanks for interrupting your studies of the mystic arts to join me for part two of our look at the first Marvel masterworks of Doctor Strange, Andrew.
By the all-seeing eye of Agamotto, I couldn't say no.
Ooh, if you don't say that one right, like the whole room starts to come apart and, you know, the sky starts falling, so...
The crimson bands of Sidorak protect me.
All right. Good save. And that first Marvel Masterworks of Doctor Strange is available in both the traditional hardcover and the softcover edition that came out last year, which I've been plunking through for these bits, which is great to have a nice reading copy of this stuff in color, which is just... I think this material really works nicely in color in ways that the black and white... in the Essentials doesn't quite capture it, but they each have their charm, of course.
I have to second that. I think it's a nice printing. The pages are wonderful. I'm no printing expert. And the color, there's an awful lot of other dimensional work, and I think the color really helps stand out. And I'm not sure in the black and white how different interactions with the astral plane and when he's doing his third eye work, how some of that translates as easily. And also the sort of backgrounds are usually have swirls of color in them in these other dimensions that I like quite a lot.
You bet. When we last left the good doctor, he had just won a victory over the Dread Dormammu of the Dark Dimension. And he got Dormammu to vow to never attack the Earth and earned himself a new red cloak of levitation and a new amulet, which now we know as the Eye of Agamotto, but it wasn't called that then. And so we're looking at Strange Tales numbers 128 through 141, which appeared on the racks on a monthly basis at the end of 1964 and all the way through 1965. And then there's also 1965's Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 2 thrown in for good measure that has the doc. So, over these 14 issues of Strange Tales, we've got two done-in-one tales versus interdimensional mystical beings of great power, and then Marvel Comics' first multi-issue epic of grand proportions. This is years before the Kree-Skrull War, over in the Avengers, and this Doctor Strange feature in Strange Tales presented a 12-issue epic that ran in 10-page monthly installments over the entire year of 1965, which was unheard of.
And I think it, as we're going to talk about it, has a really nice flow to it. It doesn't feel padded in my mind at all. The segments are self-contained. There's one or two right near the end where it's more of a cliffhanger-y feel, but I thought it's a really nice flow and a really good breaking up of the story over the 12 parts.
The first issue, Strange Tales number 128, is entitled The Demon's Disciple, and a disciple of someone known as the Demon arrives at Strange's door, and he's looking for help, but soon he's abducted right out of his clothes. And Strange reanimates the clothes in this kooky scene to trace them as they walk backwards to whence they came, leading him to this guy, the Demon's lair. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and in this instance, you see he's still, when he consults the Eye of Agamotto, it's done through the orb, which we've seen in previous issues, which it's encased in a half globe, and it folds back to reveal the Earth, and then you can use that to track the magic spells of everyone else. But what's interesting is that once he makes the guy disappear, Doctor Strange can't find him at all because he's no longer using magic. And so that's when he comes up with the gag of animating the guy's clothes to track him backwards.
And this demon guy is a human-looking guy with a pointy, sinister Ming the Merciless kind of a beard, and he's kind of rocking the Kasbah with his outfit like a Sultan of Swing, Sheik Your Booty kind of a affair going, and he's got the little green goblin tip, elf boots that look like someone that like mad artist Don Martin would draw feet that would fit within with the little toes pointed up or something. So he's a pretty kooky looking guy.
But he does remind me of the genie of the lamp.
But he's no slouch. He has a way with the crimson bands of Sidorak and traps the doc within, although he soon escapes. And they do battle. And I think these mystical battle scenes are so cool, showing spells, blocking and countering spells, and then, the spells even maneuvering around the block, almost like a mystical Three Stooges eye-poking bit done with these, hard light constructs that Ditko really convey in a great way that just moves the story right along and just what's going on.
I also like, again, we see one of Doctor Strange's common things is the feint, the fake out. And then when he does the fake out, he also takes time to study and learn the other spells of the other person. So it seems like I've commented before, I enjoy the strategy element. And he just seems to work really hard to suggest that he's sort of planning a few steps ahead of time. Sort of like I feel in a good Captain America story, that it's not just a brute force on brute force, but that there's some bigger plan at stake to win the day.
Strategery. In the end, the doc eventually enlarges his new amulet, and it swallows up all the demon's sinister spells, and then he puts a little mystical whammy on the guy to kind of keep him out of trouble. And the issue ends with a real cool Doctor Strange pinup that also is recolored on the cover of the soft cover Masterworks volume.
And he has to use his cloak of levitation, which is going to come in pretty handy. Those two gifts he got, he's not going to forget about them or not put them to use. We're going to see them pretty much in constant. And again, I like that idea that he gets a tool and he uses it. He incorporates it. It's not just some trophy to be put away.
Strange Tales 129 is entitled Beware Tyboro, the Tyrant of the Sixth Dimension. And this had a script by Don Rico. From out of nowhere, and illustrated by Ditko, of course, with edits here by Stan the Man. And this issue has a television show blue ribbon panel of scientists that are debunking the mystic arts once and for all, and Doctor Strange declines to appear, and that further proves, his inability to defend their otherwise, I'm sure, sound reasoning and everything. And then the lights go out, and then this blue ribbon panel is captured within a magical idol. And Strange arrives on the scene, and via a long-distance-like mind link, the Ancient One reels at the sight of this, what he calls an effigy, to Tyburo, the lord of the seething volcano, evil ruler from the dim, dead past. I kind of kept thinking of, the New York City Bridge, the Triborough Bridge, every time I read his name.
Ditko also loves elaborate headgear. Much like the demon, this guy has a mask that has all these pointy, three-pointed elements and a curved kind of crescent that links them all together. And I just like the, the elaborate headgear.
He and Kirby each had their own versions of their distinctive, indicative headgear, for sure. Pretty cool.
And the Ancient One also has a funky yellow hat with all these different sort of droopy spikes that hang out of it.
I thought it was funny that the doc separates Tyburo from his mystical wand by suggesting that he put it down and step away from it, which kind of made me think that the dead past isn't the only thing that's dim with regards of Ty Burrow there.
Well, it didn't seem much of a fair because he just gives up his cloak of levitation, and that guy has the wand that fires the lightning power. I'm thinking I'd rather give up, you know, if I have to give up something, Doctor Strange definitely got the advantage in that exchange.
Strange and Ty Burrow battle physically and then mystically when Ty Burrow regains his wand. And in the end, Strange pulls out a victory with, of course, the last vestige of his strength, will, and knowledge of the mystic arts. And then proceeds to mind wipe the memory of the scientists and return them, where they go on to state that magic for sure doesn't exist. But bump.
And, of course, we have to end any Ditko book with the main character sort of mostly in shadow, sort of skulking off with his half victory, half defeat on his face a little bit.
And it always gives Stan an opportunity to write some kooky farewell or, you know, some little epilogue comment.
May your amulet be eternally glowing, I think is the one we get now.
In issue number 130 of Strange Tales, we get part one of this 12-part epic saga here. And this is entitled The Defeat of Doctor Strange. And there's a great opening splash of Mordo in his robes talking to this into this mystic portal that to some being that's going to be enhancing Mordo's powers exponentially. This is one of my favorite Ditko splash pages.
The decor, you can see a little bit of it. What I think is interesting is I wouldn't necessarily know if this is Mordo's place or Doctor Strange. They all have that kind of creepy, like the fireplace and then this weird dragon statue in the front.
Yeah, there's always like mercurial things around.
the mystical, it's like that infusion of sort of Eastern, but not any specific to any part of the globe that I can determine.
So this gets going with Mordo and two mystic henchmen. Now that Mordo's had his powers jacked up, they attack Doctor Strange and the Ancient One, who are forced to go on the run. And Mordo's benefactor is revealed to be the Dread Dormammu, who's getting around his Earth not to attack the Earth directly, but rather doing it through Mordo, which he considers fair.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty shaky interpretation. I'm not sure that's exactly following the spirit of the law, but we'll let it go for now.
You're the lawyer. Doc dumps the Ancient One off, and then he tries to shake Mordo's agents in Hong Kong, but he's spotted, and he uses what turns out to be his favorite new trick to successfully escape, splitting himself into multiple images, this time four Doctor Stranges going in opposite directions.
Another clever trick is he takes his cloak, folds it up, and puts it behind his jacket. So now it works to provide the levitation power, but he's just a man in a suit walking around. Very clever, I thought.
It's like Cap's shield back there. In 131, which is entitled The Hunter and the Hunted, we get part two here, and Doctor Strange is on the run in the Orient from Mordo's minions. Among them are these pirate-looking types and also these like floating ethereal spirit ninja beings. And Strange is spotted, and he fights his way free. And again, this time he splits himself up into seven Stranges to escape. And then he's caught by the floating ninja spirits, and he splits again into six forms to escape. So twice in a couple of, you know, this thing works like a charm every time, Andrew.
Well, he also, I like that he will mix it up with the fisticuffs, and he also does a fair amount of the memory wipe thing. So if that's going to create any moral quandaries, pretty much every issue he's going to be wiping someone's memory on this thing. But they're normally bad. In this case, it's a baggage guy. And the other thing is he just barely makes his flight, which in today's world, unfortunately, you could no longer walk onto a plane at the last minute with your bags.
Yeah, I mean, you're describing his daring escape aboard a passenger jet, which turns out to be a little dangerous because he's spotted by one of these spirit ninja guys, and so Strange goes into his ectoplasmic form and takes the ninja spirit out and then garbs himself to look like the spirit ninja to wave the other ones off. Can you do that?
Well, it makes you wonder what the nature of this, it would make sense that the nature of your astral form should be subject to however you desire it to appear. Although the problem for me is they actually make it look like his astral form is putting on an outfit.
Yeah, like, the other guy's outfit. Like, if you're,
like I would have liked it if you just
in your astral form, you can take the other guy's headdress off and put it on. Can you like pick his pocket and take his wallet too?
I mean, I kind of would have preferred if he just had altered his appearance magically rather than mugged the knocked out spirit form. But you know, I'm going to take it that that's the interpretation of how the magical spell works. Coincidentally, it just appeared to be like he was putting on the outfit, but really that was a complicated incantation that provoked the same response. But it's still a clever idea to like mislead him. Oh, he went that way, that old trick. And you know, because obviously in the plane, Mordu could just sabotage the engines and the plane would crash into the ocean, and that would be the end of Dr. Strange
and everyone around him. In Strange Tales 132, we've got part 3, and this one's entitled Face to Face at Last with Baron Mordo. And the Doc returns to his sanctum in a really nicely illustrated sequence of him in the rain at night with the rain all dripping off of his hat and the brim, really with some clever line work that, you know, even the sloppiest of colorers really couldn't mess up the effect, which I think is really done nice. Not to say that the coloring's sloppy here, but we know the printing process was back then, that's for sure. And so he goes back to his sanctum, and he finds the demon there. I mean, here he's just referred to as one of Mordo's mystic demons, with no reference to having met or fought this guy, who seemed like a singular type just 5 issues ago in issue number 128. I think like Stan kind of missed the opportunity to make the connection. Even calling him a demon, one of Mordo's mystic demons, suggests that maybe Ditko had a margin note or something about him being the demon, and it didn't click for Stan or something. I mean,
I took it to be more like demon. While it can be a name, it can also be a class. Like you're an apprentice, you're a master, you're a demon, and that just indicated his title almost, yeah, more than an actual identity.
This guy's drawn exactly alike as the other character, though. I mean, even the headpiece design, and the demon even drives out Strange's astral form from his home with the crimson bands of Sidorak, which he was good with in the other issue too. He was you know, so I think Ditko intended it perhaps to be the same guy with the same, you know, power set, working for Mordo here. And you know, like you said, he's kind of referred to as seeming like he's one of many here.
And that's one of the other interesting things that I think this tale will do, is it weaves sort of feeling like this is really a global, and he taps into this network of, they're not really his direct agents, but he's more, by his newfound power, Mordu's able to assert dominance and sort of order these people around, sort of in your classic fantasy way, how the baddie unites these sort of disparate forces that would never work together. We saw that with the pirates. How he can force these people through his own power and force of will to work together, or they'll suffer grand consequences. And it just makes it feel like it's a bigger world, because they're not all part of his agency or whatever. Yeah. Like he's recruiting some freelancers for this.
I love that. It was like, we're in the Orient. Ooh, pirates. Well, the doc sneaks back into the his sanctum sanctorum, but he trips a trap set around Agamotto's orb there, and Mordo sees the trap is sprung. He powers up from Dormammu, then he shows up and really mops the floor with Doctor Strange in a defeat that ends with him fading into nothing but blackness.
And I did enjoy part of his ruse to get into his own place is to go to a costume store, and he gets this excellent yellow and green outfit with like a skull cap on it. It looks great, because that way he'll show up and he's going to pretend to be a challenger to Doctor Strange and take the demon off guard, which works to get the demon, but then he triggers the trap. But I just love the costume, which he quickly abandons the skull cap, because then you don't get the distinctive white streaks in his hair.
Issue 133 of Strange Tales is Part 4, A Nameless Land, A Nameless Time. And we learn here that his Strange's fading into darkness was actually him making an escape by transporting himself randomly through dimensions. Didn't really have time to, you know, direct his spell. And seeing the opening panel here of almost like a stained glass drawing of a white outline silhouetted Doctor Strange passing through, you know, these kind of dimensional spaces. It makes me think of the first time that I read these stories, I think, in their entirety was in the early 80s when I was buying comics off a rack as a young lad. And there was a reprint series of, I forget exactly how many issues, that were done with real nice paper and wraparound heavier covers that were Doctor Strange classics. And they were John Byrne wraparound covers. And Byrne took panels from these stories and, you know, drew them into a big montage wraparound cover for each issue. And this cover happened to be this splash page in 133, which I will scan and post on this episode's thread on the forum. This was one of them. And some of the other issues, images are so distinctive to me because I remember Byrne doing his Ditko take on these images again. Cool stuff.
Wow, I wish they could have included that in this trade. That would have really made it all the better. Yeah. I like interpretations of other people's work on
it. I mean, it's him totally just homaging Ditko, but it, you know, you can tell it's Byrne's line work too, and the way he constructed the collages was pretty cool. Anyway, here we've got Strange transporting himself through these dimensions, and he's still on the run, but he gets mildly distracted here for this part four chapter. He gets distracted freeing a subjected population from an evil sorceress named Shazana.
And we've there's also an interesting dynamic going. Dormammu obviously has his own agenda, so we'll flash back to his dimension, and he kind of doesn't think too much of Mordu, and Mordu obviously thinks he can play Dormammu. And we, of course, return to our, as of yet, I believe, unnamed female accomplice of Doctor Strange, who will play a larger role in the upcoming issues. But she provides a nice foil when we're back in the dreaded dimension of Dormammu, and she, you know, is going to help Doctor Strange again if she can. And she also frets about him quite worriedly.
In the next issue, number 134, she does just that. The woman who would be known eventually as Clea performs a treasonous diversion in the Dark Dimension. She creates a hole in the barrier that holds back the Mindless Ones, and that diverts Dormammu's attention and power to right that wrong versus powering up Mordu. Because the Doc has found his way back to Earth, and he's again immediately chased by Mordo and his spirit wraith ninja things, and this time takes them on a chase into the sun. And I think there's a really cool sequence where all these atom-like configurations all around them, and it suggests what they say is that the intense heat of the sun is causing chemical changes to their ethereal forms that ultimately could prove fatal. And the Doc ends up shaking Mordo and the Wraiths.
I really thought that was a clever way of demonstrating what would be an extreme environment that would likely be impossible to imagine standing in the heart of a sun. So it's this red background with just these what appear to be, you know, nucleuses with the electrons rotating around in your traditional pattern. And I really enjoyed that. I did want to touch upon in 133... we do have the first reference where they're going to slowly transmogrify his amulet and start to refer to it as the Eye of Agamotto. And so and when he's probing the mind of a creature, he still calls it his amulet, but he says, you know, I'm going to probe deeper by the power of Agamotto. And by the end of this 12-run series, he's going to start referring to the amulet as accessing the Eye of Agamotto, which I always thought in my older years before I'd read these, that the eye was the actual amulet. And now I believe it just is what he's tapping into, much in the same way the orb is tapping into it. So now, for those of us that grew up with later Strange, and he's always talking about the Eye of Agamotto and referencing it to the amulet, this is where they lay the groundwork for that in this 133. And in 134, when he has the mindless ones, they have that classic pose where the one has the one arm pumped down and the other arm straight out in front of him.
Yeah.
Like, that is just an iconic, like, that's the pose of, to me, that's kind of like a Kirby-esque pose almost of the hero
right.
flexed out. And I really like that one panel there.
Definitely. It's like the Herculoids. Whoa!
And they're just, you know, the barrier's down and you can't mess with the mindless ones.
And again, just Ditko so clearly demonstrates just what the story needs to be showing at that time. You know, he depicts their force in, you know, two panels. You know what I mean? These guys were really master storytellers, and it comes through on these issues. At the end of issue 134, we also get Strange at Comatose Ancient One's bedside, and he's told the word eternity that the Ancient One's been mumbling during his the times when he's semi-coherent, and the Ancient One's handler tells Strange that, you know, but what does it mean? We're going to find out, because issue 135 is part 6 called Eternity Beckons. And this is where Ditko is now credited as the plotter to Lee's scripting in the credits. And Strange is still on the run, and he's now searching for knowledge regarding the meaning of this eternity.
And what's nice, and I think I've tried to convey it, but because there's all these different scenes, there's scenes set with the Ancient One, there's scenes wherever Doctor Strange is, there's scenes in Mordu's headquarters, there's scenes at the Dormammu, it really is split up nice, so you feel like you get these nice little threads all woven together, so it doesn't feel like it's just one, like you're not just plodding along with Doctor Strange. You have all these subplots that are nice weaving in and out, and because they're all over the globe in different dimensions, the story has a real nice scope to it as well.
Absolutely.
And I just think it works. It's like a nice idea of how they split the story up in these different elements and how they decided to tell it from all these different perspectives that really work for me.
Yeah, it's not an epic just because it's the 12 parts, but it really is a global, you know, they're all over the globe, they're to the heart of the sun for crying out loud, and beyond, as we'll see coming up. But, you know, exactly, the changing locations and jumping from scene to scene, definitely cool stuff, and it certainly keeps a real nice pace, and the 10-page chunks are really seem like enough, because there's a lot of panels per page and a lot going on. You really need those those stop gaps.
Well, it makes it feel cinematic, but with an unlimited budget, because they also go through the center of the earth. They go. It's like one of the great things about comic books is, you know, you can have your sets be anything. Not to get down on modern comics, which I dearly love, but sometimes I know it's them sitting around a kitchen table or whatever, and it feels more cinema-like, because that's what a lot of movies are. But here, you know, you're never going to see some movie where they're in the middle of the sun, because logistically, how would you show that? But here, he had that great use of the different atoms, and just, I think it's really great use of the comic book medium that makes it unique in and of itself, and not just aping a TV show or a movie or something.
Here. The doc checks with, in trying to search for knowledge regarding eternity, he checks with Sir Baskerville, who's an ex and unfortunately still current disciple of Mordo, who leads Strange on for a while before betraying him in the end. And the doc has to fight and beat both Baskerville and this controlled proxy puppet of Mordo's. And at one point even uses his cloak of levitation to animate a suit of armor, which was kind of cool, before he escapes.
And then Mordu wonders why none of his spells work. I like he likes a lot of the fake out. And this is also where we first hear him say, when he's doing the mind wipe on the guy, the mystic eye of Agamotto. So we fully transformed the amulet, and now I can say without fear of contradicting continuity and refer to his amulet as the eye of Agamotto.
And meanwhile, Dormammu learns of Clea's treason by learning how she sabotaged the barrier. And in the next issue number 136, which is entitled What Lurks Beneath the Mask, Clea is taken prisoner by Dormammu, who keeps her right by his side so she can watch all his machinations occurring.
Without interfering, of course.
And Strange is still on the run here, and he's turning over stone after stone seeking information about Eternity. He even tries the mad aged Genghis, who's one of my favorite sub-characters in the Doctor Strange universe, just because he's such a whack job. Genghis inadvertently leads Strange into a trap of this dimensional body switcher type until his... You know, little red pal Clokey, the Cloak of Levitation, again comes to the rescue.
And that thing has more than proved its mettle in this case. But I like that, because it opens with a splash page of what appears to be a man in the Doctor Strange outfit with a really crazy face. And only when you realize, when you read through the story, that it's this creature from the other dimension that swaps places with him. So it's a nice fake out on the opening splash page.
Byrne did that. I think that was one of the images that Byrne redid in one of those covers. Issue 137 is part 8, When Meet the Mystic Minds. And here the Doc has to go into the Ancient One's mind to rip the information about Eternity from him. And he has to encounter many mind traps, one after the other, to learn the secret of reaching Eternity. And he finally does and learns that he creates a big giant portal with his mystic amulet and then steps within it. And that ends that chapter.
And the interesting part is that he actually has to use his amulet to provide strength to the Ancient One. So at the same time, he's kind of feeding his enemy, because the Ancient One in this coma is attacking him with all these traps. And the opening, I also like the opening page of this, because it's all done in blue. And this one would clearly work well in black and white. And it's just the profile of the two of them, with more of Ditko's magical beams interlacing as they're trying to probe each other's minds. But this one has just a lot of the great line work in the shading of Doctor Strange in the beginning, because the assistant doesn't want him to do this because he thinks the Ancient One's in peril from it. And I just really like the visuals of the two of them, and more of Ditko's use of shade and line that really make those pages pop for me, because they're not very interesting by themselves. It's just the two of them talking. But even the two of them talking, he really injects mood into it.
No one does mood better than Ditko in his prime.
And we also get a lot of my other favorite, which is Doctor Strange sweats a lot.
There you go. That's one of
the heavy set guy tools. I can relate.
Strange Tales 138 is part 9, If Eternity Should Fail. And the first couple of pages here have Strange stepping into the portal. And just an incredible mystical landscape, as only Ditko can convey, with spider-like dendritic tendrils that seem like they have a real weight and mass to them, with all Ditko's little scribbles all over them. And oh man, it's just incredible stuff. M.C. Escher would be proud.
And I also like that, as I think I mentioned before, he uses a lot of space, which really works well. Mm-hmm. So you have all these figures and lines and dashes, but there's also a fair amount of space, which to me evokes the sort of otherworldliness more than like a highly detailed background, which links it too much to one place. Because it feels like this is the crossing of different things, it feels like there should be a lot of nothing in it. And I think that works, and it really conveys to me the sense of... And he also uses less panels on some of these pages. In fact, we have our only non-title splash page in the entire issue run, and that's where we meet one of your favorite characters.
Yes, because Strange finally finds and meets Eternity. Again, another great headpiece around him, and that little half face sticking out with the cosmos silhouette cloak body. Great image. And Eternity judges Strange, but really provides him with no real help, giving him the old, the needed magic has been within you all along kind of speech before sending him on his way.
It felt a little Wizard of Oz to me. You know, you've had the means all along, Dorothy. Just click your heels together and get back there.
And I know I've quoted it more accurately in the past, but just from memory, I recall a great quote from Jim Starlin regarding comparing Ditko and Kirby's view of the cosmos and representations of the cosmos, and how Kirby gave us these big armored gods from the Celestials to the, you know, Norse gods to Galactus, and Ditko gave us like abstract manifestations of all of the cosmos and reality, you know, in eternity, and you know what, kind of juxtaposing those differences, but how they obviously both gave such shape to a rich Marvel cosmos that you can go both ways. Really cool.
And I think it, again, harkening back to the use of the comic book medium, because they do cram a lot of panels. And this one, it's a little bit less panels generally, but it really, I think it works best here. I can't imagine what a televised version or a film version, it would look, I guess, something like Galactus did in the Fantastic Four movie, which would not be as effective nearly as it does on the drawn page, at least for me.
Galactus looks so cool in video games, though. How come they can't just make it look good in the movie? So at the end of this, Strange returns back to Earth to face off against Mordu and Dormammu, which he does in issue number 139, which is part 10 of this saga, entitled Beware, Dormammu is Watching. And here we've got the Doc holding off Mordo's attacks over 7 pages of mystical battle in the Mighty Marvel manner. And in the end, Dormammu gets kind of impatient and teleports them all to an interdimensional arena.
And the Ancient One does provide a little bit of support to Doctor Strange. He can't match the power of Dormammu. But again, we see Doctor Strange outthinking Mordu, such to the point where Dormammu's like, this guy's an idiot, I gotta step in, which makes me think, what about his whole deal about not, like it seems like he's kind of abandoned. I like that he started with the pretext of, okay, I'm gonna do the loophole where I power up another guy, but
right.
I can't really blame him after Mordu screws up time and time again. He's like, you know, I'm just gonna do this myself.
So, and you know, the Ancient One spends a lot more time saying about how he can't help more than actually providing much help.
but he does give him a little boost, he says.
Issue number 140 of Strange Tales is part 11, and this is entitled The Pincers of Power. And here Dormammu uses like a little green stink bomb-y kind of a thing to put all the mindless ones to sleep, so he can focus his power on what the task at hand and doesn't need to have the empower the barrier. And so he calls a court of the rulers of all of the neighboring dimensions and then challenges Strange in front of them all to a 5-page duel, which turns out to be a physical battle with Dormammu with these mystical wrist pincer thingies, which I don't think these had to be as much of a purely physical battle as Stan scripted, because I think the force strength of the pincers could have been played up more as a function of their will or chi or whatever, but they kind of kept it being really more on the physical plane.
I think part of the, I mean, there's some things I like. First of all, I like that they got out of what I call the Superman trap. Some people may not like that Dormammu has a gas bomb to take out the mindless ones, but we had already set up a pattern, and I don't like it when you have one way and like one weakness for someone. And the weakness in the past had always been, well, you just weaken the barrier and then that takes him out of it. So I like that they came up with a way to remove that, because nothing sort of is more irritating than one, you know, there's only one way to beat this guy and that's to do X.
Right.
So they eliminate that, which I thought was smart. I think part of the problem is just the scales of power are so different between the two that you had to have kind of a strange physical meeting. Because if we're to believe Dormammu powers this entire dimension, then there's no way any type of battle of wills or whatever. I think he would crush him through sheer magic or force or whatever.
Touch him with his head. One headbutt.
Yeah. Well, the a headbutt would do him in pretty good too, but it just seemed like, I agree, the pincers seem a little a strange way to do it, but I think that they play upon Dormammu's pride. And for me, it was a satisfactory. When you have such disparate power levels, you need to do something a little bit out of the ordinary. And I felt they laid the groundwork well enough.
And don't get me wrong, I don't mind the pincers. I just think that Stan, again, sort of, to use the phrase, he sort of missed an opportunity to describe them as being more of a function of their will power and rather than just more being a literal tool,
right?
You know, a literal weapon. They could have included kind of more of that, and it kind of would have played to some of the moments where they sort of each get the upper hand over each other as momentum shifts. You know, their willpower and their strength and concentration could be shifting too. You know, but they kept it kind of physical. I think Ditko left it open. Really, could have been described either way.
No, I agree. I just, like I said, I think that even on a willpower level, I think that Dormammu is just this otherworldly, almost like a demigod.
Definitely.
And so by lowering himself to the physical was Strange's only help.
Sure. And just as Strange gets the definitive upper hand at the end of this chapter, Mordo shoots him with the old spell in the back trick and takes him down, leaving Dormammu standing triumphant.
Although the Ancient One, he deflects the bolt partially. Sort of like in Sleeping Beauty when the last of the good fairies modifies the bad witch's spell. Well, it won't kill her. It'll just put her to sleep.
Yeah,
that's what I felt here is the Ancient One who gets a lot of grief for not doing much. But, you know, he pitches in when he can. He's like the blue fairy. You know, he can't do a lot, but he pitches in when he can. And I do like the picture because Dormammu's standing over Strange face down, who almost looks headless because his collar is up so high, and there's like this smoke that's just trailing up off of him.
Yeah,
and it really looks like, you know, like the final defeat. Like, and it's just he's really great with, he can do a lot in these smaller panels. These aren't, you know, half page shots or whatever. This is a six panel page, and they all work great, and they all tell a good story.
Strange Tales 141 is part 12, entitled Let There Be Victory. And here we've got Dormammu banishing Mordo to another dimension for his interference. Forget about being helpful. Boom, you're gone. And then Dormammu and Strange fight to the finish. This time it only takes four pages for Strange to get the upper hand.
Well, I like how Dormammu's mad that Mordo, you know, interfered, and so he banished him to a demon dimension. But then he's like, well, I guess I win anyway. He's like, he's not, right. Not so mad he's not going to claim credit. And that's
I'll take the victory.
Like, yeah. hey, I'm not for. It reminded me of a boxing match when one guy does the low blow and they got to give him, like, you know, a minute apart and then get to rest. I just like how he jumps in and says, well, I guess I'm the winner. And Strange's like, hey, I'm still in it. And that's how he does a little rope-a-dope on him. Because he pretends like he's a lot more hurt, and that lures Dormammu in, and then he does this great body slam of him with the pincers, and then he's the victor.
The pincers of power. And I love the spell that Dormammu uses on Mordo to banish him. We've got, like, power, a circular power sort of blasts around his hands in the one in the typical Ditko, you know, hand with the finger sticking up, and then like lightning bolts coming from that to Mordo, and then the plane that Mordo is falling through, where he's going off to whatever nether dimension, is also on the edges wrapped like a rolled scroll. Really, what a great little image. Really cool.
You just see him kind of disappear into it, begging for mercy, of course. And I'm like, wow, that's a really hard ending for Mordo. And it's a shame they never did anything with that character ever again.
And it doesn't go much better for Clea, because even though Dormammu has to promise to never interfere and blah, 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 and go back to the dark dimension with his fiery tail between his legs, he then calls up Strange on his mystical video phone and shows him Clea, who's still unnamed here, and he banishes her to some nether dimension for her treason, which sets up the stories that follow this that end up wrapping up Ditko's run. I think he was on the title for another 6 or 7 issues before he left Marvel. And when the story ends, we also get the Hindu name of the Ancient One's handler caretaker guy, finally, Hamir.
But it feels like a real bittersweet victory, because you do realize that she put a lot out on the line, really, for Dr. Strange. Like, she definitely pitched in a lot more. She helped him multiple times, not only in the first one, but in the subsequent battle, too. So I feel really bad that she gets sent off. And I don't know how much you can trust the Dread Dormammu's word about not interfering. I think that guy might be coming back.
Yep. And all right, and this Masterworks wraps up with Amazing Spider-Man Annual Number 2, which is also a Stan and Steve production. It says it's written and edited by Stan, plotted and drawn by Ditko, and then there's even an additional caption box that says that Steve basically dreamed up this one, Stan writes. So, again, Stan did give credit once he realized that, credit should be given and that people wanted it. Here's another example of it. But this is entitled The Wondrous World of Doctor Strange, with one of my favorite splash pages of Spidey standing over a mystical globe and, well, again, these silhouettes of those dendritic, tentacly, octopusy things and dimensional spaces behind Spidey, with some really cool shadowing on Spidey's body and uniform and a pose that is really indicative of Ditko and the Silver Age.
And those annuals in the old days were kind of fun, because they were usually a couple of reprints and then maybe one new story, like in this instance, and some pinups, and just sort of a mix, a hodgepodge of different material for a little bit more money at the time, 25 cents.
Yeah, this had three other these had three other Spidey stories, and this was a new 20-page story. But yeah, for a quarter, not too bad. And here we've got this character, Xandu, enchanting and empowering two thugs to steal the second half of a wand that he has one half of already, the Wand of Watoom, from Doctor Strange's residence, which they do, and they knock out Strange in the process. But Spidey comes upon their suspicious rooftop exit, and he too is beaten in battle by them, but he tags them with a spider tracer just as they're scurrying off.
And I like that he basically puts the bad guy puts the mental whammy on these two oafs and boosts their power, but one of them lifted his outfit right from the Sandman.
Yeah,
with
that
green striped top. I'm like, wow, that guy looks exactly the same outfit and everything.
And the same coloring. That's what killed me. As a kid, I thought it was the Sandman. I remember thinking that when I was reading it. So Spidey follows the tracer signal back to Xandu's lair, and he gets banished for his trouble to another dimension through a portal, but he pulls the Wand of Watoom in with him via a web line, guaranteeing that Xandu's going to send someone to try to retrieve it and therefore provide him with a way back, which it does. There's also another fantastic panel of Spidey standing in another dimensional space, again with the cool lighting, and this one's really cool with like a Saturn planet sinking in some viscous solution and floating islands and clouds and tentacles and pathways, and just so cool.
And it's a two-thirds page, and there's a lot of open space, but there are three distinct worlds you can almost see on different planes. One has like a lake in it with these spires coming out, and another one has the sinking planet you described. So it really feels like you're in this gateway and could end up, and they're all leaning every different which way. And of course, earlier you forgot to mention, what did Doctor Strange do when the enemies appeared? Split himself up.
Yep. Worked over in his title. It should work over in Amazing Spider-Man Annual Number 2. So Strange wakes up, and he and a returning Spidey end up taking out Xandu for good. And this is the first time they meet, and even by the last panel, they still don't even learn each other's names.
And they don't. They seem all right, but Spider-Man's classic parting, "May your amulet never tickle," doesn't really seem to be in the appropriate spirit of Doctor Strange.
And this story was a catalyst for a lot of other stories down the line, which made it be even more of a classic in Marvel. Marvel Team Up number 21 in 1974. We got the Wand of Watoom back with Xandu, and I have a great plate in which was back in the early 80s. They had those cool portfolios that had several plates of nice sized frameable artwork in it, and the Marvel Team Up one is all black and white plates, and Frank Miller does a Spider-Man, Doctor Strange versus Xandu in the Wand of Watoom plate. Really, really cool looking.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
And Marvel like Fanfare in 1983 had the one that was drawn by Sandy Plunkett, that Scarlet Witch, Spider-Man, and Xandu Wand of Watoom story, which I thought was pretty memorable.
Ditko's, as you've described, those sort of bolts of light to describe the magic and the lightning. To me, that's really how I think of the Marvel Universe magic in a way. Like, it's driven all through this sort of force projecting type of thing. When you could do magic through any type of visual representation, but for me, that is like the Marvel magical realm, are those sort of direct force lights. I guess I'd compare them maybe like the Green Lantern constructs, but more abstract. But that same idea of these sort of shapes generated from them.
Right on, Andrew. There's not much by way of a meaningful cover gallery to include here, given the split book format. Strange only appeared on a few of the covers, and it was usually split at that. But they're kind of fun to see anyway, so I'll get them up on this episode's thread on the 11 o'clock comics forum and try to scan a few images that we spoke about lovingly so that you can see those as well. All right, Andrew, thanks for joining me here.
Thanks a lot for inviting me back in the bunker, Steve.
I'm glad we finally got this done. I appreciate you bearing with me as we rescheduled this several times because of my busy schedule.
Any time, any comic, you just let me know. I'm there in a heartbeat.
All right, man. As surely as our amulet glistens, we'll meet again next episode. And until then, may the omnipotent Oshker walk softly by your side. Later. Hey, con crud carriers. Bet you didn't expect to hear me again so soon, but here I am acting as your friendly neighborhood Marvel Noise Boston Comic Con correspondent. I just got back from a one-day blitzkrieg trip into Boston and back from upstate New York to attend Saturday's day one of the Boston Comic Con, which was a two-day event at the Heinz Convention Center at the Prudential Center Copley Square complex in Boston that was really easily accessible both by the Boston public transportation, by the T with stops on either side of it, and coming in on the Mass Turnpike by vehicle, coming right off of the exit, left a driver with a number of options for parking, including right under the convention center where there was over 2,000 spaces, I believe. So I was able to park right there and head right upstairs. It was happened to be a beautiful day, but it could have been a lousy rainy one, and I would have been able to get back and forth from my car to the con at will, including in the Prudential complex has also had a nice big food court, so there was really a lot of options for people to come out of the convention center and partake in what the regular Boston tourists are enjoying on a Saturday and not just be stuck with con food. And you know how good con food is, usually leads me to have a Clif Bar for lunch or something. But anyway, as your Marvel Noise correspondent, I was endowed with press credentials and had no trouble getting in, and a much smaller scale con than the New York City Comic Con, for example, which was just huge with its two big rooms. This room space was somewhat smaller than one of the two rooms at New York City. Just to get a sense of the scope. And I guess this was a bigger space than last year when it was on the waterfront. So this con is growing, and they had a number of top-notch guests that drew me from the neighboring state to drive just about 3 hours in to check it out and report back to you guys. Walking right in, there was a big, long row of tables that had some cosplayer central points. There was a Ghostbusters table with a bunch of guys in Ghostbusters uniforms, and the 501st Legion was there with their Star Wars cosplay characters. A nice array, and there was a cute charity where the kids could shoot at you know, guys dressed as stormtroopers posing in hostile aggressive poses with super soakers, which was definitely a fun thing for the kids to be doing. Also, there was a row right there before you get into the room where all the vendors and the artists' alley, etc. There was the more of the red carpet, big name row of tables that had the potential for setting up, like, you know, bank style lines, because some of the lines were long for these guys, such as like J. Scott Campbell, Joe Kubert. When I walked in right at a few minutes after 10, I just was able to walk right up to Joe Kubert and chat with him for a few minutes and get a signature from him, ask him about the school and when it first started, and what a friendly, nice guy. Adam Hughes was there in this section. Also, Frank Quietly, who just signed for the first hour and the last hour of the day, it seemed. So his line was very long, real quick, and then he just wasn't available after that. Also, there was Art Adams in this section, and he was also easily approachable and a real friendly guy to talk with. Art Adams had a real nice magazine-sized, as far as dimensions, 56-page sketchbook of sketch material and images we've seen elsewhere, all printed in a real nice black and white. But for, you know, sketchbook sketchbooks at cons are often you know, $10, $15, $20, and this big one was $20. But for its mass, 56 pages felt like a really good value, and to have it signed by Art Adams right there. And this was the real Art Adams, not the guy who was pretending to be Art Adams. So then in the main con space, again, was all vendors. There were some vendors that had toys. They seemed to be older toys for the most part. There was some memorabilia and tchotchkes and licensed material, but not really that much compared to, gosh, I guess I'm comparing it again to like New York City Comic-Con. But even just the percentage, even at a smaller con like the Albany Con that I went to a few weeks ago, you know, the percentage proportionally, I would say that there were less toys at this con than I'm used to seeing. For good or bad, you decide. Now, I didn't recognize too many faces from the forums there, which is as much my fault as anyone's. I did see in various places two guys who used to work my LCS when I used to live in Boston, the Harvard Square New England Comics location. And the one fellow was working behind the booth at New England Comics, and the other guy, I don't even know if he was still connected to them, but it was kind of neat to see guys that I hadn't seen in, almost 10, 11 years, and still recognize them and vice versa, which was kind of cool. I did run into Tim, the Freaky Tiki from the forums, and his daughter Zoe, who loves Hello Kitty, and they were walking the floors and checking out the sites. And a lot of creators around from all different tiers. There was quite a few nice prints that I saw being distributed. Neil Adams was there and had these color prints that were all washes of color, and then he would, for a $40 fee, with marker sort of ink over, you know, ink hard lines over this watercolor, which was kind of a neat idea and a fun little process, although, you know, there wasn't much creativity between the pieces, but there was a nice, a few nice DC characters that he was doing that for, which was a little different and fun to watch a little bit of him doing so. Greg Capullo was full of energy. This guy was popping up and taking pictures with people and shaking hands and real friendly, wanting to know everybody's name as they came up to the table. Was giving out free prints, which he had numbered of 200, of the Bat character from Across Town, which I guess he is going to be penciling in some form upcoming, which is kind of neat. And he said that he had been offered some type of work with Marvel, but they had been not too specific, and the negotiations, I guess, kind of went along for a while, and he was waiting for a call, and DC was trying to secure his talents as well, and he ended up having to choose one versus the other in the end, and kind of went with, I think, something that's going to match his style nicely. I think the Bat and Greg Capullo is a match made in heaven. But hopefully we'll see him over in the House of Ideas sometime after that. Frank Cho had a great hardcover magazine, hardcover-sized gallery exhibit catalog that had a bunch of his pieces, both color and black and white, from last year, from May 2010, from a gallery exhibit showing, and was signing those. I did the same thing I did last time around and had creators sign some book plates for me. So that I could then go home. They were really just white shipping labels that I had printed out an image of the Comic-Con logo, which then I could have creators sign and slap in books when I got home and then not have to carry around books, which my shoulders certainly appreciated. Declan Shalvey, of most recently of his Thunderbolts work fame, or another real friendly guy. I got to watch him interacting with a appreciative young man who was an aspiring artist. And by young man, I mean, you know, young man, a lad. and draw a Cap sketch for him inside his sketchbook, which was really neat. And to watch his process of how he just so confidently lays in his blacks. And got to talk to him a little bit about the Thunderbolts, which he's really been enjoying getting scripts from Jeff Parker on, and that I professed my love for the Man-Thing and his contributions to the character when he's had the opportunity over in Thunderbolts. And he said coming up soon is something big happening for the Man-Thing. He said something that's as big as anything that's ever happened to the Man-Thing. And couldn't say a thing more about it, so I am looking forward to that. Matt Wagner was our fearless leader. David's one of his favorite creators, was sketching an unbelievable black cat when I came upon his table, and he had beautiful prints, a Thor print that would knock your socks off, and I think it was two or maybe three colors, and I just love his simple use of color. Really neat stuff. They had some Thor promo material for the Thor movie. They had bumper stickers and you know, small movie posters and coasters that were kind of neat. And the rivals, Crosstown Rivals, had little pins with insignias on it for their upcoming movie. Also, some lesser-known artists, just to give your attention to, or maybe I'm just lesser-known to me, and you guys already know about him. One is G.W. Fisher, who you could reach at gwfisher.com. And this guy is licensed Marvel characters, incredible color pieces, the prints. I guess the best thing to say is he's got a way with the Phoenix. both of the Phoenix, one of the Phoenix sort of taking off her green outfit and exposing, no, not what you think, exposing the Dark Phoenix costume underneath, which is kind of neat, and a few other sort of tongue-in-cheek and cheesecake-type images, although you had some just regular heroic male figures as well. For my 6-year-old son, I brought home a print from Maris Wicks, and she's at dotsforeyes.blogspot.com. That's dots as a plural, dots for eyes, as in E-Y-E-S, .blogspot.com. And go over and check out her sports heroes pictures. The print I bought was 9 of these images combined into one nice oversized print. And in each of them it has a very cute, colorful drawing of a superhero doing some type of, engaged in some type of sports activity. Had Superman playing jacks, Spider-Man with a tennis racket made of web, Cap catching a shield-looking frisbee, Wonder Woman jumping her magic lasso rope, the Dazzler roller skating with pads on like she's at a roller derby, the Black Canary playing badminton, Batman playing hockey, Thor swinging Mjolnir like and about to tee off on a golf ball, and the Hulk practicing yoga, doing some deep breathing and unilateral position. Really cute. Check it out again, dotsforeyes.blogspot.com. She's got a few of those single images posted there. Pretty neat stuff. I went around again and had a very lightly printed, like draft copy printed color picture of the Con logo, which I went around and had folks sign. And whether it was the number of creators that I felt I hadn't already had signatures for on other times that I've done this at other cons, or if it was just that I was a little more lazy about standing in lines or what have you. But I had Frank Cho sign, Christopher Golden, Declan Shalvey, Matt Wagner, Joe Kubert, Darwin Cook, Art Adams, Koi Pham, Greg Capullo, Stefan Rokes, Dave Johnson, Gahan Wilson from Playboy fame, and old Erie stuff as well, Stan Sakai, Adam Hughes, Howard Chaykin, Tony Harris, J. Scott Campbell. Fun to meet those guys. I was glad to see them all out there and glad to have had the opportunity to head down. Getting out was just as easy as getting in, and I think it was a pretty good setup. I hope this con continues to be successful and grow exponentially. All right. Till the next con, gang, because this one's all done. It's over. It's been fun. Later.
Thanks, Steve, for, of course, recapping your day at the convention and for taking the time, and of course, for Andrew for coming in and both of you taking the time to talk about, one of my favorite Marvel characters, the Good Doctor. I do believe I spoke about Hulk 27 last time, and I did find the following three issues, and I believe I have 30.1 around here somewhere, so I do have that to read for next time, as well as, speaking of Doctor Strange, the Marvel Vault one-shot by Roger Stern and Neil Vogts that Steve talked about recently, and I have Marvel Girl, the one-shot, to also read, but I'm going to right now talk about, while I have you here, Heroes for Hire. I mentioned issues, when I was talking to Vince and Chris this past week on 11 o'clock comics, I kind of gave Vince the rundown of what the series was about when it was originally announced, and how halfway into this series, with the fourth issue at least, we've gotten pretty much two of those types of two issues where you had Misty give the heroes a mission, hire the heroes to do what they do, and the third issue kind of strayed from that, where we focused on Paladin, who kind of knew something was amiss. And the fourth issue, we see what Misty's doing in her head, and how she goes on and fights the big bad, or the person pulling her strings, pun intended. So as I said, the first two issues dealt with the heroes getting hired and going on these missions, whether it's Silver Sable or Elektra or Moon Knight or Ghost Rider, or and it's been fun. I mean, you had Satana, you had Paladin, and so you've had Misty having them go on, and there were drugs involved. There were and the drugs were tied into Atlantis. There were people being experimented on. It's been crazy, and I guess there's been a reason why the heroes were called in for these specific jobs, and I guess something will play into that down the line. But the third issue, and the art has still been fantastic. I think the artist is, well, Brad Walker's been doing a great job on pencils, Andrew Hennessy on inks, and of course your writers are Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning. And the third issue, like I said, with Paladin, he knows something's not quite right. Well, Misty's been lying to him, but she doesn't know she's been lying to him. He's not aware that that Misty is being, well, I guess, you know, why would Misty lie to him? So he knows something's wrong, and like I said, as he finds out that that things aren't what they seem, he decides to kind of go into business for himself. There's a when heroes meet up, they must battle type battle going on in the third issue with Paladin asking Iron Fist a question at the end of the third issue. And, you know, Danny, honorable, and you know, he's respecting Misty, and he knows that they don't have much to talk about right now. They need their space. They need to go their separate ways right now. And I'm a little, I guess, I don't know. I get the whole miscarriage thing, and I know that is not a subject that should be taken lightly. I'm trying to get a hold on the whole mystic energies thing, and how that generated a false positive, and that's the only part that really is kind of just taking me out of the whole Danny and Misty relationship right now, and how they need to get past that. They need to overcome that. But the fourth issue, not real happy about having about not having Brad Walker do the fourth issue. We've had three, and I've gone on record as being a fan of the days when pencils, when artists could, you know, do more than a few issues at a time, or not at a time, but a few issues, consecutive issues. You know, you've had maybe 10, 11, 12 issues a year by one particular artist. You know, you go back to the 80s when maybe, and they'll say, well, you know, the stories were shorter. Or the issues were shorter, rather. But you had John Byrne, who was writing and drawing Alpha Flight, or writing and drawing Fantastic Four. You had John Romita Jr. doing Amazing Spider-Man, doing Uncanny X-Men. Walt Simonson. How many issues did he go before he took a break on Thor? It's just I don't understand why you have so many, and I know there are exceptions, but you have so many artists these days who do just a few issues, 3, 4, 5 issues, and then they take a break, or they need to catch up, or they're just not as fast as the artists of yesteryear, of the 80s, of 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, and even before the 60s. And the technology has advanced. We have artists that work digitally, that I would think that with the technology, things might be a little faster, and yet we're getting less work a year from them. And I am not an artist. I do not, as much as I would love to, I don't work in the industry. So this is me as a fan, just not quite sure why things are the way they are. Why at the fourth issue of Heroes for Hire, I have the fantastic artist, the fantastic work by Robert Atkins, who we have talked on 11 O'Clock Comics. His work is fantastic. It's outstanding on G.I. Joe. He's done a few things for Marvel here and there, and it looks good here. I don't think that that the inkers really did him justice, and I did say inkers. There were two for this issue. There was Rebecca Buchman and Sandu Floria, and so they were the anchors on Robert Atkins' pencils. Still, of course, the writers are Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, and I guess there's some things that just don't look too consistent as the issue goes on. It's you know, Brad Walker, I like his Misty Knight. I like his action scenes. I really like Brad Walker's action scenes that we've seen in the first three issues. But Heroes for Hire is a book that I'm going to continue to get. I'm going to continue to enjoy the fourth issue. The last page of the fourth issue, right there, makes me want to. Can't wait to get the fifth. Seriously, the first issue had the Falcon in it. I'm a huge Falcon fan. If you've not picked up anything from this podcast, know that Sam Wilson is one of my favorite Marvel characters. Up there with Doctor Strange, I'll add. But you know, we've had Silver Sable, who we haven't seen in a while. We have Paladin, who we really haven't seen since the last Heroes for Hire series. Which, of course, was around Civil War. That series started around Civil War. Did not last long. Last a little over a year, I think. But, you know, Heroes for Hire could do a lot with a lot of the BC list characters. And once this arc is done, once Misty and the Big Bad do battle, or we find out who the person pulling Misty's strings is working for, maybe we won't just yet. Once she ends her captor's reign over her, the Big Bad will continue to evade Misty, and that'll be her purpose while pulling the heroes together. I hope this series goes on for a little while. I'd like to see more than a half a year or 8 or 10 issues of this series. It's neat. It's different than my Amazing Spider-Man fix. It's different than what I get from Jeff Parker on Hulk. It's different than really, you know, the Peter David is doing an X-Factor. I like seeing these, and the exception of Moon Knight, there are a lot of characters here that I'm enjoying that you know, I don't get to see really too much elsewhere. Although there is a Captain America and Falcon one-shot laying around here somewhere that I do also have to read that I'll talk about in the near future. But this ramble went on in a few different directions, And I just want you to know that Heroes for Hire is one book that I'm enjoying. Check it out. I know that they reprinted the first issue in Avengers number 10. I believe the first two issues were actually reprinted in a collector's edition or a Marvel must-have. But you know, I like that Marvel seems to be behind this series, and really, I'm enjoying it. And if you are checking it out, let me know. I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are on Heroes for Hire. Next week would be a normal skip week, but I do believe Steve and Kevin will be getting together, and they will have previews, which of course came out this past Wednesday. They'll have the previews episode for you in this spot next week, I do believe. So look forward to that. MarvelNoise.com is the URL. MarvelNoise at ComicBookNoise is the website address. 11 o'clock comics or forum.bullpenbulletinspodcast.com is where you can go to check out the forum for 11 o'clock comics for this podcast, for anything really. Any conversations you'd like to have, you can even check out the Comic Book Noise forums on these on the same message board. And I think that's about it. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can find Marvel Noise on Twitter. So any updates to the website will be also posted in the Marvel Noise Twitter feed. I'm done. I just want to say, check out Heroes for Hire if you haven't yet. I want to thank Steve and of course Andrew for stopping by, checking in, talking about Doctor Strange, talking about the Boston Comic Con. We'll be back soon. And I'm done. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.